Hello and welcome to another episode of the 81 All Out podcast. On this special episode, we have with us Andrew Fidel Fernando, who is the cricket correspondent for ESPN Cricket Info in Sri Lanka. I'm sure everyone who listens to this podcast has heard of Fidel and read all his pieces that he writes from covering Sri Lankan cricket. Also on the podcast is Ashoka, who's AB Van on Twitter and part of the 81 All Out gang. Welcome guys to the show.
Hey dudes.
Hey Ashoka, Sid, thank you for having me. It's very kind. Yeah, excited to be here.
Fantastic. So one of the reasons we wanted Fidel on the show is to talk to him about aspects of cricket journalism and cricket writing that we don't read much about or we don't know much about. There's a lot that happens behind the scenes. And as readers, we see the finished piece and we love it, of course. And but we don't know what goes into the writing of that piece and what goes into researching it and what Fidel goes through in the press box, what he, you know, has to, the pressures that he comes under and the joys that he sort of takes in writing these pieces. So, let me start off by rewinding a bit. So, Fidel, tell us a bit about your early influences in writing. It seems that Fidel's writing, by the way, in my opinion, is very distinct in the cricketing sphere because it seems to come from a space that from a totally non-cricketing background. I mean, when I read pieces from him, I feel that this is not someone who has spent a lot of time necessarily reading on cricket, but also reading on other topics and travel and you know, other subjects. And we can clearly see the influences that come in there. Am I right in thinking that way, Fidel? Are you an eclectic reader?
Yeah, I am actually. I'm a very eclectic reader. I don't read a lot of cricket. I never had read a lot of cricket when I was younger. I think I read a lot of the classics, I think, you know, from Hemingway to sort of Kerouac type stuff, to all the way to a lot of great South Asian literature as well. But I mean, I did read cricket info. I read your stuff. I read Osman. I read Rahul. And I think the love of cricket writing really started reading those kinds of pieces and feeling that these writers were bringing the game alive for me in a way that had never come alive for me, you know, before. In terms of, I would watch a match and then I would read a great report, a great match piece, and then it would make me think about things that I'd never thought about while actually seeing it. Mukul Kesavan is another one who I really enjoyed reading growing up. So that's probably where it started. And you're right. I mean, I think my role as a writer, as a cricket journalist, is not to maybe bring readers into the ins and outs of what happened on the field, but to make it relate to their lives. And so my approach to it is, how do I write about this day of cricket or whatever it is I'm writing about in a way that, you know, your ordinary person can connect to it?
That's an interesting a point that you bring up, because given the amount of cricket that's played these days, do you also feel a certain pressure to watch a lot of cricket? Because there is cricket going on every day in different corners of the world. And do you feel that as a cricket journalist, it is incumbent upon you to watch a lot of cricket and be informed about it? Or are you somebody who would rather take a step back and maybe take a break and do something else and then catch up on what happened by reading about it?
No, I'm definitely one of the people who switch off. I think it's really important to me, for my mental sanity, if no other reason, to try and step away from cricket and do something else, have a life outside of cricket. And I also find that it's really interesting way, you know, the players that I relate to most when I talk to or I interview are the ones who've had a life outside of cricket, who can talk to me about different aspects of what they go through, you know, day to day. We can have a conversation about something else other than cricket. That's a great lead-in to a cricket interview. I always find that if you can talk to someone 5-10 minutes about something that you're mutually interested in, then suddenly you have their trust. You have a relationship going that's outside just the mere professional reason why you're there. And I find that with a lot of interviews that I've done, that having that other thing that I'm interested in, that they're also interested in, makes a huge difference to how the cricket interview actually turns out. During the whole sandpaper gate last year, I was on holiday with my family in a completely remote place, turned up, did not check internet, did not have any access to Cricinfo or anything else. I check my phone after I get back from there, and suddenly Smith and Warner have been banned for a year, and I'm, you know, my jaw hits the floor, and then I catch up. So that is quite a common story. So I do definitely switch off a lot, and I don't watch all the T20 leagues. That's not for me. But I it is important to be well informed, so I do read a lot.
So you were the guy who was living under a rock when Sandpapergate was happening.
Yeah, well, underwater actually. I was on a diving trip, and I was just having the time of my life. And then I got back, and I actually could not believe the headlines. I thought that I was checking if Cricinfo was doing an April Fool's Day something, because it was near the start of April, and I just did not comprehend why Smith and Warner could have been banned for a year, and I had to catch up on all of that, and found it both entertaining and intriguing from just why Australia would go down that route.
The people who are following the news during the Sandpapergate felt that they should have been taking a vacation. I mean, it was covered to an extent where further coverage was not possible at all. The scrutiny that the Sandpapergate got kind of eventually led to the punishment, right? The punishment was for the publicity and not for the crimes that were committed or whatever that was. There's no proportion.
Yeah. I see what you mean. It was basically a trial by the public, and the public's reaction, and then also the ICC went a step further than that, and they brought down all these very harsh ball tampering rules. When I think a lot of people in the game know that ball tampering is quite a widespread thing and that a lot of teams do it. But the ICC sort of reacted in this very moralistic fashion because of the coverage that Sandpapergate had got, as you said, and also because of the public's apparent reaction to it. I don't regret being away for that couple of weeks, for sure.
It's really interesting because if you go to YouTube from 1992, there is a interview with Imran Khan on BBC, and it's like one of those hard talk interviews. And then there's a person asking the interviews, and then there's Imran Khan who's sitting under the limelight under the spotlight on a chair. And then in the audience, you have all these former cricketers. And he's being grilled about ball tampering because 92 was when Pakistan, Wasim and Waqar and all these other bowlers were accused of ball tampering. And Imran is being grilled about it. And then he says, he wrote a piece in the Telegraph that said that I did pick the seam of the ball once. And a lot of people in county cricket have been doing it forever. And, you know, this is not something that people need to make a big deal about. If at all these Pakistani bowlers did it, then why not punish the thousands of other people who have also done it? And it's an amazing discussion. I can link it at the end of the podcast. But I feel that this was 92, but today there is no possibility even of that having such a discussion. I mean, can you imagine Steve Smith or David Warner coming there and saying, other teams also use sandpaper? And then it's just inconceivable to even have a rational discussion with players now. So the volume is so high. So in a way, it's good that you go away, because when you come back, even though you're catching up on what happened, the intensity is still not as high as it would be if you're following it real time. So which brings me to my next question about, can you talk about your typical day when there is no cricket going on? Because a lot of people know what you do when the match is on. They read what you write. But sometimes there's no match and I mean, maybe there's no news to file as well. There's nothing that you write. So what do you generally end up doing?
Yeah, I mean, if any editors from Cricinfo are listening here, what I do when when there's no match on is you know, file profiles and file features and work on all that kind of stuff. But if I was being super honest, yeah, there's a lot of days where I just take time off, and I, you know, today I went diving. Though today was an actual off day. Spend time with family and do other things that interest me. Do some reading. I think reading is one of the best things that you can do for yourself as a writer. You come back as a better writer every time you read good writing. Those are the kinds of things. So there is always something on Cricket Info to do. There's always some work that requires a little bit of your time. But then you do work so hard when, you know, during tours, you're often doing 80-hour weeks. So I used to feel a little bit bad when in my early years of Cricket Info, when I was taking, when I had days when there wasn't match coverage, I did feel bad that I wasn't working an 8-hour day, but then, you know, you do enough 80-hour weeks to think, okay, it's fine for me to have a bit of a light week this week because there was so many, you know, there are match days sometimes when you're filing 5,000 words. And so it's okay to take a little bit of a break when there's not that much happening.
So from my experience of full-time cricket coverage, I noticed that on the day that I used to get off, I was so exhausted that all I would want to do is sleep or laze around or just basically do nothing. I wanted my mind to have complete rest. And so, and then the next day it was again back to work. So does that sort of fatigue begin to set in for you as well? Or have you found a way to bypass that?
No, I think fatigue-wise, I don't really get too fatigued. What I do need is I need my mind to engage on something else. So if it's a different project, I really enjoy cooking as well. So on my days off, I'll make, you know, curry powders and five spice and all these kinds of things that we need for our kitchen. I'll learn how to cook a new dish. Or I'll do something like going scuba diving, which is a very sort of mental intense activity, but it engages your mind in a completely different direction. I completely understand the exhaustion side of things. There have been times when I felt that. I think after covering long global tournaments, definitely there is like 3 or 4 days where I cannot physically do anything, cannot focus on anything for long enough because I'm so mentally spent. But generally, just on a month to month basis, I try and focus on something different. It might not be like a relaxed activity, but it's just something different for my mind to focus on. I find that helps.
So, talking about overseas tours, your latest overseas trip had so much going for it. And Fidel was in South Africa, covering Sri Lanka's famous Test series win there, whitewash teams. I can't even believe I'm saying it. A team went to South Africa and whitewashed them, and it was Sri Lanka. So tell what I'm interested in is for you to talk about both the Test matches, but through the lens of you writing about it. So that first Test when Kusal Janet Pereira was batting. There must have been some point of time when you were ready to file your copy of course, saying that Sri Lanka had lost and filing it from that angle. Or are you somebody who waits for the last ball to be bowled, irrespective, and then starts to write after gathering your thoughts? Yeah, talk a bit about that experience in the press box when Sri Lanka won that test by one wicket.
Okay, I mean, to talk about that day, I'll take you back. So when it was announced that Sri Lanka was having these three back-to-back overseas Southern Hemisphere tours, New Zealand first, then Australia, then South Africa, when that was announced, I thought, actually, you look at the venues that Sri Lanka are playing in, Durban, Port Elizabeth, the two most spin-friendly venues in South Africa, the two slowest venues in South Africa. I thought at that point, you know, months before, that maybe Sri Lanka had a chance. And then you saw them go through what they did in Australia, where the entire bowling attack was injured. You know, literally, the team that played at the Gabba, the entire attack had to be changed for Canberra because because two bowlers were out for weeks, and Surendra Lakmal picked up a back stiffness injury, and then they got absolutely smashed at Canberra as well. And then on top of all of that, there was all this stuff going on in terms of administration and not getting on with the coach. The coach felt like, you know, I met Chandigarh Singh. I had an interview with him maybe 2 days before that Durban match. And Hathra Singh has seemed convinced that people were conspiring to get rid of him. And then on top of all of that, there was a new captain, Bimal Karanath, had just come in. And the conversation I had with Karunaratne the day before the match also was quite a depressing one. I mean, he was just saying, well, you know, what are we going to do? All I'm trying to do is get the team out to dinner. That's like my number one goal at the moment. Forget anything that's happening on the field, because I just want them to gel and to forget about everything that's happening and to sort of focus their mind on just being together and having a meal together, because maybe then they'll relax and all this other stuff that's happening around our team can be forgotten about, and when we go to the middle, we'll be, you know, refreshed and not be weighed down by all these extraneous things. So I went into the coverage of that test thinking these guys have no chance. I mean, I think you'd be completely irrational not to think that. And then, you know, they did well on the first day, and you thought, you know, they've done okay, but there's still a long way to go in the test match. But the important thing is that they kept hanging in the test match. Ambul Benia's 5-wicket haul in the second innings was pretty key. But then, you know, they get down to, I think, 78 runs to get with 1 wicket to go, and Kusal Perera and Vishwa Fernanda batting at the other end. Again, I'd completely written them off. What I had done is when you're riding on a test match day, especially an exciting finish like that one was, you sort of rank stories in your head about what you could do. I thought maybe I'll write a story about South Africa. South Africa continuing their home dominance. They'd been beating Pakistan that series. They'd won 3-0 against Pakistan that summer. And then Dale Steyn bowled that wonderful over where he got 2 wickets. And I'm a big Dale Steyn fan. I love watching him bowl. I think he's probably been the greatest spectacle that we've had in our sport over the last couple of decades. And that over had everything in it for me. And so I started writing a paragraph about Dale Steyn. Turned out that I could use that one later on, because Kusal Perera's tussle with Dale Steyn was really the one that defined that innings for me, because he not only quelled, you know, Dale Steyn at his most hostile when Steyn was doing well against other bowlers. And then those 2 sixes towards the end of that innings just sealed it. I mean, those were just audacious in the extreme. And you couldn't quite believe that Kusal Perera was deigning to hit this all-time great bowler over mid-wicket when he hadn't even bowled a bad ball. I mean, either of those two balls were remotely bad deliveries. And so that, thinking about Dale Steyn earlier on in the day, got me into the mode where I needed to write about this battle between the two of them, and that needed to be sort of central to the story. And then it's just about relying on your experience as a writer. I knew that I had to write something dramatic, because what had happened that day was really dramatic. And whenever something dramatic is happening, what I try to do is I try to go out into the stands and watch it from the stands. But when you're in the press box, there's glass in front of you. You're not hearing it as well as you should. You do have better access to replays, but you don't really get a feel for the game. You don't sort of get it flowing through your veins in the same way as you do when you're out in the stands and you're watching it, and you're hearing the crowd's reaction. You're hearing the batsmen call to each other. You're hearing the bat on ball. All of that brings you closer to the game in a way that you never really feel in virtually any press box in the world. And so I did that. And so it was then just a case of channeling that into my story. And in retrospect, there are things I think reading that story back, I probably could have finished it a little bit better. The last 3 paragraphs could have been a lot better, but But I think I'm reasonably happy with how the tone started and how much drama I was able to infuse in at least the first half of the story in order to bring the reader in. So yeah, that's how that story came about, really.
So that entire month of February was a magical month, man. I mean, even if you go back to December, where India won a series in Australia, and we began January with one insane innings from Tisara Pereira in the ODIs in New Zealand. And just before that, in the tests, I think Angelo Matthews and Kusal Mendes played a day out without getting out. And we come down to January, we have this West Indies England, where we know for sure what the result is, but that's not the result. And then we come to South Africa, Sri Lanka, where we know what the result is, but that's not the result. Definitely. I mean, when February ended, we were like, what the hell is happening to cricket?
Is this even... I remember your tweet that said, the Amy Vance tweet that said that, okay, so now Afghanistan is winning the World Cup then.
Yeah, I mean, this is the year. I mean
that would be the story to beat all stories, right? Like that Afghanistan winning, and yeah, if things are building, I think everything's been an escalation so far. Kusal Mendes and Angelo betting out a day, and then West Indies took a step up by beating England in the emphatic fashion that they did, and Sri Lanka took another step up by beating South Africa 2-0 at home. So it's got to build up from here until Afghanistan win the World Cup. Afghanistan just won their first test, so I'm looking forward to the World Cup if that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, and once they win it, everybody's like, yeah, we should have seen this coming. The signs were all there. I mean, we just missed the entire thing.
Yeah, there's something strange in cricket's waters right now. So let's hope anyway. Let's hope that they get a good run going. I think they really can, because the attack that they have is one that's so capable of surprising better teams, and so many teams are so wound so tightly going to this tournament. I think England are wound really tightly. South Africa are wound really tightly as usual. And a team that has nothing to lose, like an Afghanistan, is so capable of taking down some of these bigger teams. I think India is going to be a much tougher proposition. Probably Pakistan is going to be a much tougher proposition for a team like Afghanistan. But the teams that sort of overanalyze and overplan and have a lot of pressure coming from their media and their fans at home, those are the teams that I think Afghanistan can really aim at. And take a really good run at during the tournament. So yeah, I hope that there's something magical happens there.
And last time there was one such format in the World Cup, in the 92 World Cup, a team that was literally like packing the bags came back and won it. So why not?
Talking about these upsets, that as a writer and a journalist, are you often caught between writing about the upset with a sense of surprise and wonder, and between having to actually finding reasons for this upset? As a writer, are you almost impelled to come up with that one or two reasons why the overarching story or the narrative that is it? Or can you sometimes say that, hey, there's absolutely nothing we can do to explain this. This happened, and boom, that's it.
I was thinking about writing a piece on how it was completely inexplicable. And then we had a press conference with Dimon Karanath, and at the end of it, and Karanath is one of the best speakers in world cricket for me, at least. Maybe not in English, but when you talk to him in Sinhala, he's very, very expressive and is able to verbalize his thoughts and what's gone on in the team very honestly and very very articulately. And he and when we asked him about what went on during the series that enabled his team to win, he actually laid it out really in a way that made sense in terms of how his bowlers went out there with rough plans, but no real plans. They hadn't done a lot of scouting on the opposition. They hadn't done a lot of, drilling down into what the flaws of a Quentin de Kock or a Faf du Plessis or a Hashim Amla might be. They just said, you go out there and deal with the situation that's on the field and bowl the way that, you know, you're used to bowling, which is probably a really smart thing to say to young, inexperienced bowlers, which is what Sri Lanka had during that series. And when the batsmen went out there, they were just told, you go out and bat with freedom, try and reverse pressure if you want to, bat out overs if you can. And there wasn't really a strong blueprint or a strong team plan going into that series. And it showed on the field, because looking back after that press conference, I sort of made all the dots join in my head, because you saw the way that Ambul Denia performed, the left-arm spinner performed through in the first test. You saw the way that that other players made key contributions. Kasun Rajit, Davishu Fernando made key contributions through the series. And it was clear that they weren't really bowling to a set plan as such. They weren't playing with strong concrete, you know, boundaries in their minds. They were just told to go out and deal with the situation on the field. And so many great Sri Lankan performances have come like that through the course of history. And so it was only after the match happened, after that press conference happened, that piece really sort of took shape in my mind. Before that, I was going to write about how insane it all was. But I suppose there is a little bit of pressure to explain what happened. But as I said earlier, I mean, I try and err on the fans' side of things rather than the cricket side of things. If there is, I try and give voice to the fans' emotions as well. So if there was nothing to write about, if I didn't have that insight, I would have been very happy to write a story about how crazy it was and how wonderful it was for Sri Lanka fans that they were given this win after such a long, difficult season, such a long, difficult couple of years, really.
So one of the things that fans do, they watch a lot of games and they come up to they, of course, have their own theories about why certain things happen, why certain games turn. You know, there are all these terms about the match-winning spell and the and things, but I think at the end of the day, they are looking and searching for why things happened, and whether the fact that you picked up on that insight and then built that piece around that, I think it resonates, because of course it is part, you've been there and you've seen the anecdotal evidence of this happening, but it's also, I think, for somebody reading it, it's new information. It's something that they don't know. So I think that was a very well done piece for that reason. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
The second tests, right? I mean, Kusal Perera's innings, at least we could bring it into some kind of a context, saying that this is once in a lifetime innings. Even though we say it's once in a lifetime, in our lifetime, we have seen like two or three innings that has happened that way. And we know that this is quite special and it won't be repeated anytime soon. But the second test, the way Kusal Mendis played, man, I was watching it for that precise reason, because it was on the... I think they needed around 160. I don't remember much, but it was a very tricky chase. And him and Fernando were kind of the last hope of set batsmen to carry it through. And the way Kusal Mendis played that day, I mean, it kind of reflected what you were writing as well. It was a uninhibited innings. Like, he was batting as if he was playing some club game where formalities needed to be finished. And it was Rabada and Steyn and Olivier on the other end. It was stunning to watch. I was like, oh, this is a special innings. This is what we're seeing is a...
Yeah. And for that reason...
The control of it, yeah. More than the exhilarating part of it.
Yeah, and for that reason, I think Kusal Perera's innings was, as you said, was just crazy. It was just something completely outlandish. But Mendis and Osha de Fernando played a wonderful innings in conjunction with Kusal as well. If you told me at the start of the day, I mean, I think they had 132 to get from memory on that final day. If you had told me at the start of the day, You know, would it be a nail-biting finish? Would it be a Sri Lanka loss? Or would they get it with no further wickets lost? I would have told you you were crazy. There's no way that they're going to get it with no further wickets lost, given the strength of the South Africa attack, given the fact that so many wickets had fallen the previous day. I mean, South Africa had got out and Sri Lanka had lost a couple of wickets. And I think earlier in the day, Sri Lanka had lost a few wickets as well. So I think it was something like 16, 17 wicket day the previous day. And so you're obviously not going to get a zero wicket, 132 run partnership the next day, right? But again, that's apparently they were not told anything. They weren't given any instructions. They were just told go out there, bat, chase it as well as you can. And Kusal Mendis is someone who I think I've seen him play three really special innings. I've seen him play that 176 against Australia and Palakkali, which at the time, before Kusal Pereira's knock, was the best Sri Lankan innings that I've seen live with my own eyes. And then I saw him bat out 141, not out against New Zealand, batting out the entire day in conjunction with Angelo Matthews. And Mendis batting out a whole day is a different thing from Matthews batting out a whole day, because Matthews has that stonewall gear, whereas Mendis had never previously shown an aptitude to bat out a whole day. So that was quite cool. And then you saw him just absolutely bossing that chase. Dane comes on and he hits him for 3 fours in his first over. And you saw the way that South Africa sort of became more and more wound tighter. Like they would just become more and more constricted by the way that that Mendis was batting at. And in contrast to that, Ursula Fernando Mendes, as you said, were just completely free, completely unshackled. And that probably led into that piece that I wrote as well. I mean, you see two teams, one that just became more and more boxed into a corner through the series. South Africa talked so many times about the fact that Sri Lanka's inexperienced players had not been seen by them before, that their scouts, their video analysts hadn't seen Richard Fernando and Kasun Radha too much, that they hadn't seen too much of the young Sri Lankan batsmen had come, so they weren't able to formulate the plans that they normally do in a test match. But Sri Lanka went the complete opposite end of the spectrum in terms of approach and won it 2-0. So all of this only made sense in my mind after it had all unfolded. But yeah, looking back, that Mendis innings was something special, and and he's also such an elegant batsman to watch, as is Ursula Fernando, so that was great as well.
Yeah, but I'm a big fan of Dhananjay De Silva, because the 176 that you mentioned, I think Dhananjay was at the other end, and in that partnership, and also I think Dhananjay had made 100 in India when he was batting with Roshan Silva, if I remember right. So yeah. I was kind of, I have like a cricket crush on Dhananjay De Silva, because he embodies what we Tamil people call assault. The assaultness of it all is I don't know how it translates in English. I can't remember the English.
You should try and translate it though.
Yeah. Would laconic be the word? I mean, laid back, laconic, relaxed.
Lackadaisical, but not in a negative way. I would say more like, you're like Mark Waugh is probably classical assault, right? I mean, that laid back, insouciant kind of batting.
I get you, yeah.
Which brings me actually to, Dhananjay De Silva is a good segue, because one of the things that Fidel does is very well is write long player profiles. He's written quite a few of them for the Cricket Monthly as well as Cricket Info. And my personal favorite is the one he wrote about Rangana Herath.
An all-time favorite, dude. It's I love it.
Yeah, and as much as, everyone who hasn't read the piece should read it. Those who've read it should read it again. I'll link it. And I think what's really important for cricketers is, I mean, I'm not saying it's important for their careers or anything, but for a fan, it's as important to have pieces like that as it is to watch Herath bowl, because on the one hand, you see
what he does on the field, and then on the other hand, you actually see the big picture and where he's from and how he lives his life and how he speaks to, you know, interacts with his neighbors. There's one fantastic bit in that piece about how he is talking to a couple of neighbors and they're talking about trimming a jackfruit tree, and then Fidel goes into explaining what the jackfruit tree means in Sri Lanka's cooking and in life. And it's I think as I spoke, the rhythm of the piece has a very Herathian tune to it. And I want to ask, talking about that specific bit, I notice this in many of your profiles, is that in that Herat piece, when you, you're obviously the bystander there, but when he is talking to his neighbors, and when they're talking about this tree and jackfruit tree, and then when they're talking about whether he's retiring or not, you quote that whole exchange, you know, verbatim. So what I want to know is, as a writer, are you... you know, constantly, you know, you have a little notebook in hand where you're noting down what people say, or do you have a recorder, or is it something that you immediately went and sort of transcribed? How does it work? Because I'm just trying to see from the writing point of view.
Yeah, as soon as I saw that exchange happening between him and his two neighbors, well, one neighbor and a neighbor's friend, I knew that that was going in the story. I knew straight away that this is, as soon as it started happening, actually. And so I made, I don't take many notes, I don't take many physical notes, but I have a pretty good memory for conversation. And so I knew exactly, I can still play that same conversation over in my head about how exactly it went. Because I made a mental note as soon as it started. I'm like, I've got to remember this. This has got to be in the piece. Because it was just so wrong in Herat, because he was slightly embarrassed by it all. So his neighbor was saying, they started talking about the jackfruit tree. And then as soon as his neighbor switched around to talking about his career, Herat was sort of embarrassed by it all and, you know, didn't really want to go too deeply into it. But he was always almost making excuses to his neighbor about why he had retired from limited overs cricket, and it just captured his personality so perfectly, and yeah, from a process perspective, I just knew that I had to put that in. No, I don't make notes. I generally come home. So I came home from that day and I wrote up like a skeleton version of that paragraph while it was still fresh in my, or those few paragraphs while it was still fresh in my head. And then I fleshed it out later when I went back to write the whole piece. I'm not a big note taker. I find, for me personally, I think a lot of journalists, a lot of writers are different. I find note taking gets in the way of me actually engaging and interviewing the subject, because what you want to do, especially in a feature interview, especially when you're writing a big story on them and it's and you want to capture them as they are, what you want them to do is you want them to interact with you as a person, not as a journalist. You don't want them to be reminded that you're actually in an interview, and you want them to be as honest as they can be. You want to be sort of a friend almost in that situation where you're talking to them and they're just interacting as they would with anyone else. So I, for that reason, I don't take a notebook with me on these, but I do come home and write notes up, as soon as I'm done with it.
So for two reasons that particular article found a great resonance, for the first reason, like having not been to Sri Lanka at all, I kind of imagined, Herat being the locale that you portrayed in that article, very similar to somewhere, it could have been in somewhere in Kerala or somewhere near the Western Ghats, and it would have fit perfectly, right? I mean, it's a kind of a rural setting, semi-rural setting, and it's kind of a laid-back area where this great cricketer is kind of spending his life, and I kind of made that adjustment and I could picture that perfectly. I mean, the whole article ran as a film in the mind. And for the second reason, that this kind of scene is, I don't think, is possible in India. I mean, if a player gets 400 plus wickets and is a bona fide legend of the game, he's not going to have a laid back life. This is not going to be possible in India. But so it's also intriguing in a way that this is happening in another country which is playing cricket, and players are allowed to have a semblance of a normal life. So in a long and roundabout way, I'm trying to pay compliments to Fidel saying that. Yeah. Like that is one of the few articles that stay in mind. Like when I say, yeah, that Herat piece, and sometime before I keep making fun of the other piece about Chandrapal, which was also a fantastic one. But the Rahul Bhattacharya's
piece.
Yeah, the Rahul Bhattacharya piece on Chandrapal.
Yeah, I read so much of that. Every time I try and bring, every time since that Chandrapal piece went up that Rahul wrote, I try and bring a sense of place into one of my pieces. I almost inevitably read wonderful section of that Rahul piece about how he's lying on the hammock with his daughter, and the guy selling vegetables comes past, and the guy who's sort of asking for money comes past, and it's just such a beautifully atmospheric piece of writing. And I'm not just talking about not just cricket writing, but it's just a wonderful piece of writing, in general. That Rahul Bhattacharya piece, I think it's one of the best profiles of any kind that I've ever read. So I did go back to that, and that was sort of a reference point for me while writing that Herat piece. Probably I've read that Rahul Bhattacharya piece so many times. While writing the Herat piece, for sure, that was a reference point for me. So it's interesting that you made the connection as well.
It was completely subconscious, because I didn't plan to make that connection. It just popped into my mind that these two are of the same genre, as it were.
Yeah, and it's probably because I've ripped him off completely and I owe him royalties or whatever. But yeah, that's part of the reason. But going back to what you were saying earlier about Sri Lankan and about Sri Lankan cricketers, very few Sri Lankan cricketers have the kind of life where they're sort of completely besieged all the time. A lot of them can have normal life, which is why I think it's fun to be a Sri Lanka cricket correspondent, because they don't really get a sense of being... There are a few cricketers who are sort of larger than life or think that they're larger than life in Sri Lanka, but the vast majority are very relatable. You can have a conversation with them, and they have a sort of rapport with not just with journalists, but with anyone. They have a natural way of talking to each other. They never, very few of them get, too big or try and talk down to anyone. And that's great in terms of access. Like as a journalist, I'm super lucky that, when I was writing another profile that I did was about Kumar Sangakkara. And this was when he was at the absolute peak of his powers, really, like at the end of his career, where he was scoring hundreds for fun. And I was able to spend, a couple of days with him. And that kind of access you probably don't get too many places in the world, because you don't have the sort of culture around cricket that we do in Sri Lanka. So that's I'm very, very privileged in that way, in that I'm able to have those kinds of conversations with players.
Which brings me to your favorite topic, Fidel, which is the Sri Lankan Cricket Administration. I think... a few people have created such a comedic portrayal of it as you have. I mean, I often read your tweets about it or read your pieces about it. And I feel sometimes that you are writing about the same issues 100 times, but you're finding ways to write about it in funnier and funnier ways. It gets into, some of these pieces get into the dark comedy zone almost. And you're like... yeah, I'm finding it very funny, but it's also very tragic that this is happening. So my question to you was that you also cover news in Sri Lanka. I mean, and I guess for news, you would want to be in the good graces of the administrators, at least in terms of having chats once in a while and finding out what's going on. But at the same time, you're also a commentator who needs to take a stand on the inefficiency and the absolute shambles that SLC often finds itself in. So how do you draw that line, and how is your relationship with the administration. Because in India, we have reached a point where if you are critical against the administration, then you risk a chance of losing your accreditation. And it has happened in a few instances in the domestic scene and things. So I just want to understand how it is for you. And you obviously can say only what you what won't get into you into deep trouble. I don't want to put you in trouble after this.
No, I think if I was going to get into trouble over this, I would have already got into trouble given the things, the kinds of things that I've written about Sri Lankan cricket administration. I think the great thing about the Sri Lankan cricket media is that a lot of them are critical, and I'm certainly not the only one who's virulently critical. There are lots of great Sinhala, probably Tamil writers. I don't read Tamil, unfortunately. There are definitely great Sinhala writers who write and portray Sri Lankan cricket in its truest form. Others who write in English as well, Rex Clementine, who writes The Island, always often very critical of things that he does not like. And so if they were going to cancel accreditation, they would have to do it en masse to a lot of us. So it's not like I'm taking this personal brave stand against SLC. It's that we, you know, us cricket writers as a group share this perspective, we have our differences. Like, I don't agree with everything that other cricket writers write, but I don't feel like I'm stepping out on my own and taking a big risk, and that is quite an emboldening thing as a cricket reporter as well and a cricket commentator, because you know that you have others who are doing similar things, similar if not identical things. And the thing about humor with regards to this is that if you didn't laugh about it, you'd have to cry. And laughing is infinitely preferable to sobbing over how the state of the cricket administration. It's
amazing, because over the last few years, Sri Lanka, especially in Test cricket, have perhaps been one of the most watchable and exciting teams. I mean, they went to England and they won the series. They went to Pakistan, UAE, and they won the series. They went to West Indies, drew a series, and now South Africa and winning a series. Of course, they've had the downs, but I feel like the term mercurial is often associated with the Pakistan team, especially the Pakistan team of the 90s. But I feel Sri Lanka in tests have been not only mercurial, but also like at times surprisingly consistent. Not many teams can boast such a record.
And this is not counting the home series, which have been like tremendously exciting, right?
Exactly.
And our only problem, like we in India have a problem that whenever there is an India-Sri Lanka, it turns out to be the most one-sided, boring series ever. And that's how we paint all Sri Lankan innings, because we have a biased point of view. But whenever any England or Australia or South Africa visited them, it has been a riveting series. Like, and so is it when they travel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that pretty much covers everything I had in mind. So hope you all enjoyed the 81 All Out podcast with Fidel. There was plenty of insight into Fidel's writing and his life beyond cricket. Please read everything that Fidel's written. I'm going to post some links in this podcast. Also, as he mentioned, there's a travel book that's coming out sometime. Please, I'm sure it'll be a delight. And you can also subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Podcasts and various other platforms where you get your podcasts. So that's it for this episode. And until next time, goodbye.